Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Albert Morales, and today's conversation is with Dr. Ward Cassells, Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs. Also joining us in our conversation from IBM is Terry Ergens. Dr. Cassells, we characterize the military health system as a global system delivering health services anytime and anywhere. Now, I understand over the last couple of years, you've taken some bold steps to redefine how your organization works. Can you take a moment and just tell us a little bit about this new vision?
Al, 2 years ago, we had a problem on our hands in that our care at Walter Reed Army Hospital was questioned in a series of articles in the Washington Post. If you read them carefully, the frustration was primarily with outpatients who were having long waits to get their disability evaluation. They were struggling to get appointments. And some of those guys had had head injuries or they were stressed. That makes it hard to navigate any kind of medical system, much less a complex bureaucratic one. In many cases, their families couldn't be with them because they live in the middle of the country or the other side of the country. So they were alone. Some of them were sort of lost. And that was unfair to them. We needed to do better. And although there really was no one questioning the quality of the, say, the surgery or the choices of medications and so on, nevertheless, the doctors could have been more advocates for the patients and insisted on a simpler system and not acquiesced under the weight of the military bureaucracy. So we were taken to task on that. The Secretary of Defense relieved several very prominent people of their duties. I was brought in, and we faced a number of problems, how to improve care and make it better. The big issue is how to make it simpler, how to make it easier on patients, particularly people who were head injured, for example. So simplifying care is not so simple. Yet that was one of our tasks, to maintain high quality, but to try to make things simpler and keep them fair. To do that, I asked for help because I knew I didn't have an MBA or a master in public policy. I had been vice president at a university hospital, but I had not run a whole healthcare system. I'd been an army doctor, a patient in Iraq. I knew a little bit about the frustrations of the system. My records had been lost. So I was just a regular Carl Malden G.I. Joe who'd been through it. I didn't have a simple answer for it. I knew one thing, it was that the answer was in the military if we could just unlock the knowledge, the experiences of the enlisted personnel, the non-commissioned officers. I knew I didn't want to ask a big, expensive consulting firm. We had a million of them calling the first few weeks I was in office, and I told them all that I didn't need a consultant to borrow my watch and tell me what time it was. What I needed to do was to hear from the enlisted personnel and the NCOs and the junior officers. The junior officers were talking about quitting. They were saying, Dr. Cassells, we got a black eye that we didn't deserve in the Walter Reed coverage, and we're out of here. We don't get paid much. We might as well go private practice and make a decent living and not be criticized in the newspaper. So I said, wait, guys, please don't leave. Hang in there. Let's fix this system. And 2 years from now, we'll look back on this as one of the proudest things we ever did, was dig deeper, examine what we could do better, be advocates for our patients, and I'll make it up to you somehow. And almost everyone stayed. They did work harder, and we also asked them to work smarter. We asked them to work transparently, and I tried to set the standard by starting in my website every day to write a blog, to take questions, and to answer them the same day. Sometimes it's the next day, but you know, I've got 9.3 million beneficiaries and 137,000 employees, and if every one of them can ask me a question any day, and I answer it. Sometimes a staffer will suggest an answer for me, but usually I answer them myself. Admitting what we didn't know and taking their suggestions with these electronic web town hall meetings, answering their posts on the blog, that won us big points for transparency. It rebuilt some of the trust that we had lost. And, you know, and we won a bunch of awards for that website because I think I was the first person in the federal government to be blogging every day and then the first person to let people post comments on the blog. So that was an innovation that paid dividends. And I guess the other thing, emphasized patient choice, giving patients a choice in every way we could. Fourthly, we've worked hard to empower our medics, giving the medics more sophisticated tools for medical care in the battlefield, teaching every soldier and Marine combat lifesaver skills, basically first aid. So by pushing that down, if you will, some of those medical decisions and getting everybody to be almost like a medic, that helped us a lot. And another thing was pay for performance, where we began to reward our hospital commanders for hitting their targets in quality of care and cost effectiveness and patient satisfaction. We began to put more money in their hands based on their how they performed, rather than just in the beginning of the year dividing up the pie and giving this much to the Army Surgeon General, this much to the Navy Surgeon General, and saying, here, give it to your commanders as you see fit. We said, no, let's actually make sure that funds are distributed based on documented needs, and then secondly, on performance.
So any large transformation obviously hinges on some level of cultural change within that organization. It sounds like you've really touched on some of the key tenets with the transparency and the communications and driving to a lower level. This capability with the initial care. Any other lessons learned as you reflect back?
I've learned three lessons. One I brought with me, I think, and that is being an athlete as a student and a coach as a father and not having any management training. My management approach was that of a coach. You know, be there in the locker room, be there on the field. So I'm at these military hospitals myself almost every day, and I make rounds. I see patients, I examine them, I talk with the residents, I talk with the families. I make the rounds unannounced. You might call a mystery shopper experience. We have all these different hospitals, and I'll just drop in and grab the residents and say, let's go make rounds. Or I'll sit in the waiting room and watch how things work. And I'll go up to the nurse's desk and count how many minutes it takes before someone says, can I help you? That has helped me more than anything because I learn what's going on. And secondly, nobody knows but that I may drop in that day and in their hospital. Right. And I think that's a useful thing to drop in unannounced. But that's one thing that has helped, I think, is, walking the deck, as they say in the Navy. The other is being a cheerleader. If you highlight the good things that are happening and seek them out, talk to people about them, hold them up in the light on the website and, in various other ways of bringing attention to the good things that were done, then you have earned the opportunity to point out the shortfalls. If you just go around in a very practical way and say, don't tell me about the good things, let's fix the things that need to be fixed. Well, people get tired of hearing that. You have to focus mostly on the positive, and that gives you the moral authority, if you will, or at least they're willing to listen to you if you're most of the time positive. And then they'll put up with a certain amount of tasking about the fixing the shortfalls. None of what I've told you is probably taught in a business school, so it's pretty simple stuff.
Well, I would argue that you just probably gave two years' worth of MBA programs in 2 minutes. So for all those that may be out there in school, save your money. Just follow those two lessons that you just articulated to us.
Yeah, Dr. Cassell, is based on great efforts from your physicians and as you pointed out, the troops in the field, the wounded warriors are really surviving at an incredible 97% rate compared to previous wars, World War II, 75% and 85% in Vietnam. But however, the success has created some new challenges for the military health care system. Could you elaborate on some of those critical challenges and how your organization is working to address them?
We have some unique challenges, Terry, in that, for example, in Afghanistan, the mountains are so high, the Hindu Kush, 15,000 feet, getting a evacuation helicopter over those mountains is no simple task, and doing it quickly. We're treating casualties in the snow and in 120-degree heat in the summer in Iraq. So these are really difficult limiting factors. And when it takes time to get to the casualties, it becomes all the more important that the battle buddy and the medic, the combat medic or corpsman, have the skills they need. So we train our corpsmen and our combat medics together in San Antonio, and they start with simulation, computer-based stuff, not just book learning. A lot of these kids are 18, and many of them really weren't book-oriented as kids. They were action-oriented. So when you want to train them, you've got to train them in that format. So video game-type training, and then get them in the field-type simulations with mannequins. And it's quite dramatic the way we've changed the training of our medics. So they can do much more than they could do a few years ago. In terms of medications, in terms of assessment of the patient, in terms of ways of protecting the airway, treating burns on the field. Keep in mind that these guys also have to shoot to protect the patients, and they're also warfighters. They have a very difficult time, and so we've lost 210 of them. That's been a big issue for us, getting these corpsmen and medics up to speed and finding that they can do so much, really more than civilian EMT B-level, civilian emergency medical techs. The next big issue is the evacuation. You have to have enough helicopters, and you have to evacuate the casualty to the place that's best equipped to take them. So you have to know if this field hospital has a neurosurgeon who's available, or maybe somebody's been operating for 36 hours and is finally getting some sleep. You don't go to that hospital. You go to a different hospital. So having that real-time communication to know which hospital to go to and alerting them before you get there, what kind of casualties you're bringing in, terribly important. So this system has been worked out in the theater of operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. And then what everyone knows about, I think, is these CCATs, they call them, the Critical Care Air Transport Team. These C-17 aircraft and C-5 aircraft of our Air Force really are now mobile intensive care units. And they take our patients from Balad Air Base in Iraq, Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, take them to Landstuhl Hospital in Germany, and then home to Walter Reed, Bethesda, Brooke Army Medical Center, Balboa, often in as little as 48 hours from wounding to being stateside with their family at the bedside. Of course, the family plays a huge role in their recovery. Nothing I've told you depends on doctors. The medical evacuation from the casualty collection point on the battlefield all the way to Landstuhl Regional Medical Center in Germany, mostly run by medics, corpsmen, and nurses. There's some short-term operations done in Iraq and in Afghanistan. These are typically resuscitative-type surgeries. Get in there and stop the bleeding. The medics can stop the bleeding with tourniquets, arms and legs. Chest and abdominal bleeding, doctors got to go in there, clamp something off. So the doctors have an important role, and certainly they have an important teaching role, but I want to emphasize that medics, corpsmen, nurses, and the system is a big role in the improvements. It's not just that we've got some dressings that stop bleeding better than we had in Vietnam. There are many system improvements.
Dr. Cassells, in the previous segment, you touched upon traumatic brain injury, or TBI. I've only got about 2 minutes, but I am interested in learning more about what's being done in the areas of prevention, assessment, and the treatment of TBI, and specifically what you mentioned earlier around how to break down the stigma for folks in terms of seeking mental health care.
Al, the traumatic brain injury, which has often been called the signature injury of these wars, results from the fact that we have better helmets than we used to have. So we have fewer penetrating head injuries, but more shaken brain type injuries. even studying what we've learned on the from professional football players and car crashes in the United States, we don't know enough about traumatic brain injury. So what's happening to our soldiers here and our Marines who've had these injuries is a first for us. We've never had so many, and the silver lining there is that it gives you enough patients you can actually study it. It looks like most are recovering pretty well. They often have some associated eye and ear injuries, which is also tough, but most of them are bouncing back. It's still a challenge to diagnose them, but if someone has headaches, dizziness, double vision after a blast, you know they've had a concussion, particularly if they were knocked out, had groggy thinking for a while, they had mild traumatic brain injury. It's about equally common as PTSD, but with PTSD, it's more complicated because soldiers often have some feeling of guilt about that, which they shouldn't. Sometimes it's overlaid with depression or with substance abuse. One of the issue of stigma that you mentioned is an important one, Al, because if you don't get people willing to come in early and talk about the stress they're under, then they get to functioning poorly, obsessed with stress, thinking about themselves too much instead of the mission. They make a mistake, and then they have something to really be mad at themselves about. So the Secretary of Defense, Dr. Gates, and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Admiral Mullen, have both been highlighting this. Many of our general officers and admirals are highlighting this, talking about stresses they've had. I've talked about the fears I had before going to Iraq, and we try to point out that you can, if you face these things and you overcome them, that maybe that really marks you for leadership. Now, the Army's taking it very seriously recently. They've had, they're embarking on another chain teaching experience where everyone in the whole Army has to get training about mental health and how to recognize stress in a battle buddy, emphasizing to the non-commissioned officers they should know who in their squad has gotten a Dear John letter, mm-hmm. who in their squad has kids who are messing up in school or getting involved with drugs or falling behind on their mortgage. The NCO leaders need to know their people well enough because these people are at risk. So these are some of the things we're working on in addition to putting about $300 million a year into medical research. But medical research may never get the answer, and if it does, it won't be this year. The old-fashioned things about making sure people aren't abusing alcohol, you know, doing drugs. You know, Dr. Cassell's come with me. This is the day for your random drug check, and I'm going to be with you in the bathroom, sir. You know, that works. Right. You just got to do it.
What about DOD's work with electronic medical records? We will ask Dr. Ward Cassells, Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs, to share with us when the conversation about management continues on the Business of Government Hour.